Welcome to the third installment of the Traveller's Halt and the third Rhyme Travel podcast. If this is your first listening to the Rhyme Travel podcast, you are not going to know where we are in the story, so I advise to go back to the beginning. For everybody else who's been following the story, I'm going to pick up from where I left off. The girl. Ben had been licking at the bloodstains left around his muzzle. He also sniffed at the scent encased within splinters, the sword Audie had left protruding behind tied in part of her dress. Some blood had absorbed into the wood grain and spread in a long mug-coloured stain that had stretched. It didn't dull or dry until the host of it was dead. When Keir had died and took his last breath, the blood disappeared and was etched to become a weird texture on the wooden-bladed threat. I could sense his intention, she said to Ben. He's a descendant of the men who defile common sense. Vile, horrid stench seeps from their vents. Ben's attention switched. As the last droplet dripped from the end of his nose, he attempted to lick it from midair and missed, turning to fix his gaze upon a beflutterfitch that flew in random lifts and dips. As she walked further, she came to a signpost, removed from its hole as if pulled with a rope. Skullis Gate and an arrow, it read. That makes sense. A skull and a gate, not a head and a fence. She looked at Ben. This map gives clues to where I am, then. Of course, Ben did not react, even to his name. Being wild, she had not made any attempts to tame. At the moment, she decided that feeding was enough, but felt a bond between them that she recognised as love. Pink sunset fills the surrounding light with ambience, giving every texture a lift looking candlelit. The steady graduation was impossible to notice, but now set in, it is incredibly potent, rousing peaceful emotion. She had to stop and allow it to open her up. Sipping from the cupped hands out of a spring near the roadside, she clocked the sound of a horse closing nearby. She was going to hide, wait for the rider to pass, but Ben had other ideas and ran out fast. Wait, Ben! She reached out of her grasp, so followed and awaited as the rider drew up. Hello there, miss. And her bear cub. What a beautiful eve. A rare chance to share one. I'm Herbert Dean, and this is my steed, dubbed Keith. Herbert Dean didn't look mean, or any kind of sleaze. He was the right amount of neat, crooked but at least white teeth, his facial symmetry made incomplete by an old scar across his left cheek. The cleft's peak reached underneath his hairline, jet black, swept back with casual spare time. His age was at almost shaving fair lines into his face when practicing with a straight razor. Good evening, sir. My name is Ordelia. This is Ben, she glanced down. We're on our way to the next town. Any idea of how much further down? She smiled, avoiding his eye, taking herself by surprise, making sure not to get tongue-tied. Skullis Gate? Sure, I'd say 4 hours on a slow walk. Of course, by horse, it's faster, she smiled. Thank you for that extension, but I'll walk and enjoy the descending sun today to watch it ending. Herbert turned his horse and trotted alongside her. As you wish. It's a beautiful thing to witness. If you should find yourself tired, cold, or just feeling alone, and you make it as far as the farm, then that's my home. The green door is mine. You're welcome to spend the night, and don't think of that as assumption. Unless you might. He dipped his hat to her. She cast a smile to the ground and noticed Ben now hanging back. I'd better feed him. I might happen by this evening. I plan to spend some time in Skullis Gate for reading. And there is someone I am meeting. Who? He asked. I have no idea, she answered fast. This was true. As she turned to walk away, he threw, I hope to see you then. As he continued to move, he made a gesture she didn't recognise, so she waved. You too. The Toop. The Toop ship beached in port on its own. Deep beneath deck, David's body lay prone, supposed to be asleep, but he so longed for home, the curse couldn't keep his mind from its roam. He had to believe his family, though alone, were helped with their needs by his friends to cope. Please, he hoped, now hugging his knees and stroked his shins to grope at the burning yearn to be free from this hole. Brian stirred next to his wife. In his sleep, he spoke about kites. Despite her strife, she accepted her life, unable to change things either way at this time. She could, however, affect time's line by neglecting to respect her husband's design and intent for their child. As time escaped, Folly watched as she climbed over the blind that covered a hatchway and slid through to the other side. As time stopped to check if she had been caught, like every other time, Folly closed her eyes, pretending to be asleep so as not to untie. The choices made by her daughter. Inside, she felt a deep sense of pride at her drive, but with fear for her fortunes, she cried. That same night when most Toops slept, Mr. Rook of Sixth sent forth his spies to collect information on the subject of Captain Priest. Whispers came of the ship like a tree heading east, across his waters to the Eighth Sea. He was displeased to have only just been informed of such things, but was happy to have the information indeed.
"You'd plot his trajectory towards Farrington?"
he asked his associate, after having done the payment via handshake established once you reached the status of these savage thugs. He relayed this information to Gwent, after waking her up feeling tense, knocking at her door. Her twisted face was not one he wished for in a woman to adore, but he couldn't help but feel they had a certain rapport. This could have been the fringes of her uncontrollable magic, filtering out to anyone that it could latch. It usually grabbed men who had nothing but graphic thoughts in their mind running frantic. She answered the door in the same black gown that hung loosely draping around her wrinkled flesh. The island that sent her off her rocker to recline affected her body as well as her mind. Rook didn't want to do what he did next, as her features made him sick as a reflex, but he leaned against the door and suggested the subject of knocking late at night subtext. Gwent's stone face dismissed his advance and asked, "Any further progress on Captain Priest's present stance?" Rook told Gwent of Farrington, now pulled from his trance. A fishing vessel had seen them advance. Gwent clapped. The Toop forces were all awoken with a finger snap.
"All hands on deck to close the gap,"
she said to herself, with Mr. Rook looking slack-jawed as Toop troops rushed past his back.
"You'd better get off board before you're napped,"
Gwent said, closing the door on the latch. As Mr. Rook watched them leaving port, feeling glad that he hadn't been caught in the trap, he realised that when he paused on his thoughts as they hatched, that his feelings were not forced, nor were an act. The kids. As they headed deeper into the woods, the foot-marked, arched, mud-paved routes, pathways that once stood, veered away from the booms. Red had insisted the crow-flown route, only Fen had resisted when his toe had shown through the end of his sock.
"I'm getting a blister on the other toe too," he booed.
"It's not much further, Fen, move,"
Sai shoved him in the back, forcing him forward as if to attack. Fen stepped on a branch that then snapped and hopped twice while reaching to grab at the foot that felt sliced but was scratched.
"Guys, shut up,"
Red hissed as he tucked his head down as if to be missed. The forest around them gradually got darker. They all looked up as cloud cover passes overhead.
"I think it's going to rain," Levin started.
Just as he had said, the cloud then burst, blasting. Thick flicks on the leaves came first, starting a tirade of heavy hailstones that traversed, asking if they should be departing. Sai sided up to Red, began imparting his view about their charting on the map and how long this would be lasting. Before this meeting with Captain and Second had started, Levin and Fender ran around regarding the strangeness of hail in this season.
"How weird,"
Fen flailed, then began sneezing. Levin failed to see that Fen had stopped to wipe snot on his sleeves and knocked into Fen, sending him to his knees then.
"Sorry, mate, I was dizzy."
Levin lifted his friend, suddenly feeling embarrassed. They stood arms linked as if they were married, until Sai pointed that out and Levin dropped his carry. Fen was now covered, head to toe in mud, ice balls, bugs, and one shoe off. He looked down at the floor, where the white frozen balls had started to form, a tight, concise, broken sprawl pattern adorned.
"It's only passing," Red suggested. "The smell is beautiful," Levin said,
whilst the humidity became refreshed with this came a sense of rising stress, lift. The hail passed on. All too quickly, the miracle was gone. Levin then posed a question that they had all thought. "What are the claps that we are heading towards?" Four blank faces. After Sai drank patience, accepting no one else had an answer, he pranked Basic.
"Perhaps it's the echoes from Levin's butt spanked making their annual reverberation?"
Levin had tense relations within his family situation, far greater than being disciplined in Sai's demonstration.
"What do you know, Sai? I'm listening. Come on, I'm waiting. I'm really interested in your fascination with my home life, mate."
Sai shrugged.
"Leave it out, Levin. You know he's dumb."
Fen stepped up to silence this at once.
"My foot is sore already, and I'm covered in scum. I'm cold, my sock has lost its threading, and I haven't had a crumb. I'm already regretting agreeing to come along. We'll soon get to where we're heading."
Red smiled at Fen's depressing monologue that he was betting would carry on if given the chance. They walked on. Ahead hidden lies a path behind a gate called Kissing that swung on a hinge between two sitting posts and rails. Several snails had died, leaving crusty trails. Red had walked right past it calmly. So had Sai, who had used his stick to disarm leaves. But in between him and Fen walked Levin, who had spotted what they can't see.
"A kissing gate, but just goes into the undergrowth, no path beyond it. But I wonder, though."
"Those thorns will catch you horrid, perhaps even cut your throat,"
Fen spoke, feeling worried the adventure where the sun won't go. They stopped and stood beside it for a while.
"There must have been a path behind the stile once.
We will only know if we try. The only problem is, to pass by, we'll have to kiss each other, guys. Red frowned deeply around his eyes. But the direction we want to travel in this is aligned.
It's fine, said Sai. Me and my brother do it all the time.
His eyes grew wide.
I mean, we did when we were young. Now we both just kiss our mum.
Doesn't everyone? Levin said and jumped when Sai punched him in the arm. I don't reckon we should do it, Fen sulked.
No one's here to see if we just peck each other.
What?
Sai said as Levin made a face as if he would be sick. I'm not kissing you, Levin, or Fen for that matter. Shit.
Just kiss Red then. We all know you can't wait, but I'm not going, Fen ended the debate.
Look, we all go. Otherwise, one will never hear the end of it, and we don't come back this way unless we have a pretty girl to kiss, Red declared. So be prepared. What lies ahead, I'm unaware, but being fair, this is the best place to share a dare. No one will see outside our lair.
He then pushed at the gate, breaking the vines that taped it closed to the post. Forced harder against, the bottom still had to scrape in the mud before he could go all the way around it, so he could then close. Red turned, and so the boys got to kissing. Sai pecked his cheek and went through, kicking the gate into Fen, who kissed Sai, then pulled away quickly. He squeezed through, turned round, meeting Levin, who looked sickly. He kissed the soft, chubby cheek of Fen, feeling tense very swiftly.
Forget it already, Red said. They spat as if removing any germs that came in contact.
In front of them now is thick overgrowth, tangled, wound, woven clothes, limbs, weeds and leaves, small trees and shrubs that hope to see the sunlight streams.
We need to push through these bushes and find the track. If you see a branch, just grab, twist and break it in two. Force your way forward. Scrape, slip, get through.
The captain. 30 or so men cut a path across fields, ignoring roads, fences, flattening nature's yields. Whatever grows or is built hasn't a shield to protect it from men who care not for fields. Priest dug in his heels when he spotted a sign saying stand well, aligned, towards the cursed place where he had been robbed of his purse at the shrine. There was a town in the distance that they swerved in a neat little curve towards the cliffs to where the treasure had been unearthed. When they happened upon a little church with a few houses around here, they learned of two riders who burst through the hamlet in a berserk fashion, but the locals weren't sure which way they had traversed.
How absurd! For that, you are cursed. Perhaps your memories can be stirred. Boys, teach these folks how we assert control over twerps.
The crew began. Death followed. Heads were hollowed, eyeballs swallowed. No time for witnesses allowed to wallow in mourning. Any seconds borrowed were stopped. Faces were stomped, tongues were lost, and only one was left to count up the cost. He gave a rough direction of which way he thought the riders were going, but couldn't be sure, since this hamlet's road exceeded four. The scenic course they chose seeded thoughts of juxtaposed positions. Mirrored, the two scenes couldn't be more different. Ahead, rolling hills and sunsetting show a reason for priests to hold on to hope. Behind, his act fills with smoke, masking the dread and wonder-pressed bloke trying to douse the church on his own. The girl. After feeding Ben, he seemed content to walk alongside and hear her vent.
I think we'll spend our time walking the bends. Talk about Master Dean, our new friend. Only it seems that everyone I meet wants to kill me.
This may be an obvious need, as you're a bear, but believe human beings are capable of love. I witnessed it firsthand from my mama and my pop. But since they left, it's been non-stop. You're like the second thing in my life that's made me stop and think maybe all the love didn't disappear back when they did. Now I have that feeling back. Was it that boy, or is it in fact this cracked clock's face that causes a relapse?
Ben didn't react, but walked along the track. She carried on until night fell, creating black. Usually she'd make camp, but tonight Ordelia removed her bag, reached into the sack, pulled out a torch in the form of a match, struck it against the floor till its catch sparked and relaxed. She didn't like the dark, nor the fact that moving through it sends a shiver up your back.
After a time she could see the farm. The windows glowed with a light that warmed, even from the distance that she still had to walk. Upon approach she decided that she would talk to Herbert Dean and request a pause to blur her scene and address the thoughts, spurred by dreams, unless, of course, he preferred the need of something more, and then she'd leave. She doused the torch.
Now, since you're wild, Ben, you'll have to stay in the stable. When I come back, if you're there, then I'll know you're probably my pet for time to share.
As they got closer, she felt a little odd. A strange feeling, as if she was being watched. She turned around but couldn't see a spot, just darkness. Stop, you don't get scared, Aldelia spoke to herself and stared. What right had she to be there? Stood outside the perimeter of light cast by the windows of the farms inside, waiting in the shadows with her back against the white wooden side of the barn. There was no further sense of alarm, but she wouldn't be disarmed. Now her blood was up. She couldn't find her calm. "Shall we carry on, Ben?" she whispered into the night. Ben made moves as if to head into the light. "No, come on, we can find somewhere else, all right?" He obeyed when she made her way to the right. She followed the road away from the farm and put distance between potential harm or false alarm. The Toop. No ship like a tree was in port, but upon questioning the fourth drunkard in the harbour, he did report, told of a gang of men who had run sword through a community of elders at Fork who lived their life based on a book that taught,
"Never mind the story of their lives or wives, you dork. Which direction is that course?"
The man pointed north, looking shocked. That timid old woman could hold so much force. By the time the Toop soldiers came ashore, they had drawn much attention at the port.
"March on!"
their leader had roared from inside a carriage that Brute carried forth. Greg and his band of practice swords marched up now ahead, aching to taunt any opponent with what they had been taught by each other. Duncan thought of his dead mother and prepared to further withdraw into himself as his body walked. How lucky she had been a corpse shortly after the curse held full force. He began limping to dwell and catch more glimpses of the audience at the port. As far as he could tell, no one thought that they were prisoners, only pawns. David managed to stay aboard. He had damaged the panels on the floor and wedged them under the door. He then tied one arm to the bed to be sure. It hurt his head as they left. He screamed for help and clawed at his face to concentrate on a different pain as it bored from his chest to his legs and beyond. Outside, as formation aligned, Brian looked at his wife.
"You know where she went last night,"
he spat between tight, clenched jaws. Spittle entered her sight as she yawned.
"I know not of what you talk,"
Folly walked, concerned for her daughter, but sure she would be safe in her course. The other. Hidden by the cast of nightshade, outside the farm, looking at the light it creates, behind the silhouette of Aldelia and a smaller shape, as she debates whether or not to enter Herbert's place to sleep safe, this rank figure stands and waits. A wind that travelled all the way from 8th whirls around a crack in fate. It swerves at the man, lifting hair from his face in the white light that the moon's shadow creates, contorts it to look like a snake's. Beady eyes and lips drawn away, he sucks in the air through each side of his teeth and holds it as if to taste. As she turns around looking this way, he swallows it. Above, the cloud covers the moon's shape, in turn sending him back into the shadows again. Words in the black are said, and sorrow sits tense. As she carries on further towards Scalis Gate, the scavenger moves onward in a hurried state. His breathing is heavy. He walks to the green front door, standing steady, grasps the hefty iron knocker shaped like a berry. Clasped in his sweaty hands, he lifts and then he lets go once. The berry thuds. A dead silence bleeds into the sirens that bad deeds bring. Footsteps sing. The bars of light that slice their way around the door's leaf are broken by Herbert's feet beneath, out against the body of this no-shadowed thief. The kids. Branches bore against Red's cheeks, that were then slapped into sized teeth. Fenn squinted and barged his way on, while Levin crouched behind his back into the beyond. As they dragged themselves out of the thick overgrowth, sure enough, a path was exposed. After catching their breath for a few short moments, the clapping reminded why they chose this opponent, the woods, the sound, adventure-bound. The noise surrounds their current ground.
"We're getting closer to whatever is cracking," Red suggested to the group.
"No slacking," Cy encouraged, checking the view.
"What if it's gunshots?"
Levin posed worriedly. Fenn disappeared behind a tree to go for a wee. Over his shoulder he looked back, making sure Cy wasn't sneaking up to attack.
"Fear not, Lev. If it is, by the time we get there, everyone'll be dead. My bet it's a racetrack, and with any success, we will happen upon it from the edge and have no need for tickets and watch from a ledge."
He buttoned up as he finished and said,
"Besides, we can just hide if it turns out to be some evil spirits."
Lev scratched his head. "Cheers, I feel so much better," he replied, toe-punting a weed repeatedly.
"I mean, I can see the curiosity, but equally, no one knows we're here, and we're probably out of bounds by now. We've been walking for hours."
"It's actually more like one," Red interrupted, looking sour.
"I didn't come this far to turn back now, and besides, we don't have any bounds. Even if we did, we're only kids. We can't be blamed for breaking them a bit. Once we get closer, I'll go ahead and check out the sound and see what it says."
"Not without me,"
Sai wouldn't let Red out of his sight. On that, you can bet. The sound had ceased, aside from a few pops here and there that would occasionally crop out of the air.
Ouch! It's not fair!
Fen had stepped on a stone, not for the first time since his shoe had gone rogue.
That was a sharp one that time.
He was limping again and lagging behind.
How about me and Sai go on ahead? I reckon it's only a little further, Red said. How can you tell? The sound's gone dead.
With my great sense. Look here, wait by this fence. He pointed ahead. As they approached, they noticed a road on the other side.
We could just follow that and civilization we will find, said Sai.
We could try, but it takes us from the path that the sound did provide, Red applied. I'd say to cross over this fence and keep going through the wild.
Sai forgot his idea and nodded in a no backbone style. Fen and Levin agreed to wait next to a Goliath oak tree standing giant as the two boys disappeared into the silence. Fen wished he had been more compliant. The girl. The clock in her possession, made of twisted wood and glass, was enchanted by her mother but was her father's craft. He had made more, they were given to his family, and when looked upon and thought, a link you were establishing. That was the idea, but this was not explained, and along with a map that gave no clear view of what's near, Aurelia could only wait. She slept outside on her first night in Skullis Gate, cuddled up close to Ben to add weight to warmth. She thought about heading back to the farmhouse, but the warn had felt too strong. When the morn came in full song, she awoke to see shadows form. People were wandering to and from different shops. She was safely tucked out of sight behind a box for storing rubbish overnight. Ben had already awoken, but didn't leave her side. And when her eyes were fully open, she could tell why. When it was dark, the surrounding looked rather stark, but now with light cast, the amount of buildings standing sharp upright could be remarked. They were imposing to a wanderer and an animal who lived out in the open. Aurelia took the clock out of her bag, looked upon its face, feeling sad. The closeness it offered wasn't as strong as it had been before. Could it have lapsed? Or should she just wait for that feeling to come back? Staying in Skullis Gate seemed the logical answer. She packed away the clock and swung the bag up after getting up and started trying to find a place to stay until whoever she was waiting for showed their face.
Come along, little bear. Don't just sit there, she said as she set off down the pavement, aware that people had begun to stare at her talking to a bear cub with little care of attention.
The buildings were built out of grey-looking rock, with brown-tiled roofs on top, and small leaded windows to look out of. Aurelia approached the Traveller's Halt, a grand public house that looked old due to its faults. Beams outside were peppered with a salt speckle that was spores of a kind of mushroom petal that made malt settle. A metal gargoyle at the peak of a spire dripped charred oil down the tower of tiles. The arched wooden door was ajar, and hanging flowers swung next to Aurelia as she prepared to enter. Ben cowered.
I'm sure you're allowed,
Aurelia said, reacting to Ben's stance. She opened the door and remarked, a fat, surprised-looking lady at the bar.
I don't suppose by chance you require any staff?
Aurelia asked. The woman rolled around on her stool, looked at her and laughed.
You're welcome to wash pots, miss, but the bear must be tucked in the stables or luck might see him cut up quick. Chef Hat is a tricky one. Make your way out back. But it's slippy, love. Watch your step.
The fat woman fell onto her legs to guide Aurelia to the kitchen. Behind her, she could hear the barflies whisper. She soon forgot about all that when she met Hat, the strange chef who resembled a cat in part. He moved very fast and had a hairy face like a mask. Ben was ushered out of the back door where he waited, curled up on the floor. He doesn't like to leave my side, Aurelia thought. Her post was nearby the opening, so she assumed this Ben could cope with. Chef Hat then approached her.
You must be diligent. Do everything I ask as quick as this.
Chef Hat made a motion with his arms like a flailing twist.
Do you know what a skillet is?
He asked. Yes, Aurelia replied.
And this?
He held her eye until she looked to where his hand had flinched. Yes, that's a dish.
Very good, Chef Hat said, convinced. We must prep,
he finished, and left her at the station to become familiar with the set. A large ceramic sink with 12 taps, each with a different twist. A hose connected to the sixth with a metal switch on its end. Aurelia glanced towards Ben, resting his head on the door's ledge, watching her with deep intent. She motioned to him that this was below her depth and smiled to herself as he rolled onto his left. A large cork was plugged inside the hole of the spotlessly clean but cracked wash bowl. Aurelia checked it was stowed deep enough so it wouldn't come loose with the increasing load she was about to introduce.
The first tap had no flow and spun loops. After she tried to tighten it back to where it wouldn't move, the second spout turned in the same direction. As she twisted the fancy head, expecting water, a soapy slime came to be resting and slowly dripped down the back section of the basin. The third valve released a high-pressure pacing of streaming water to be sent, creating a sudden rush of bubbles from the soapy invasion. The fourth tap ran cold. Ordelia thought this was good to know. The small droplets from the third had been enough to scald. The sink gradually filled. Behind her, a noise came as if something was being killed. Ordelia spun to see it revealed. Chef Hat was wrestling with an animal concealed by the pots and pans in front of her field. A large tentacle covered in a congealed clear substance that seemed to peel from it appeared. Ordelia looked approaching to vomit. She would, had she been able to see beyond bits of saucepans and orange slow-cooking dishes. The torrent of sounds to follow reminded her of gutting the man she then left to wallow in his gut when she was of a younger sorrow. Another time, not one to borrow in mind. Splashes of slime came into sight. Hat reeled back with some in his eyes, but with a pure look of hatred he continued to try and see that this creature met the end of its life. Oh my! Ordelia turned to the side, wishing not to witness any more of this ride. She looked back to Ben, who had adjusted to his side to provide a better view of this sight. She turned back to the sink. It was almost full to the brim. The thick bubbles bob up and down as they swim against the current the water gives as it flows its way in. She quickly spun the taps back tight. It was then she remembered a room for the night would be a good thing to secure before the day gives up light. Today was short. The moon would be forced, blocking rays of sunbeams starting with fourth. Her thoughts were cut short as the landlady then walked into the kitchen to squawk,
"Service!"
Chef Hat, along with the whole village, heard this. He burst into action, raising his burnt fists, discarding the firm squid fish, sliding it over to the side, saying,
"Learn quick."
He ignited the burners with a turn switch. After filling many pots with an assortment of lots, he moved them to cover each hob. This wasn't Ordelia's first job, and this wasn't the usual way that chefs adopt. "He's cooking for orders he hasn't got," she thought. He went to the back room. Ordelia watched him move and flicked her eyes over to Ben as he groomed his paws. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Hat's figure once more. In his arms, he had caught so many ingredients for a variety of cuisines and more odd sorts. He dumped them on the counter now behind him. She slumped against the sink, finding him more and more interesting to watch. He stood in front of each pot, reaching behind him. He blindly groped at what he got and grinded, sliced thin, applied with slight flair like a designer taking great care adding the random findings. Pink fruits, a lynx tooth, and pulp of a sink root in bulk, a sweet group of peach too, all ground, the meat of an owl, and feathers as well. Never a doubt, on his face showed aloud, grains of rice, mice removed twice as still alive, and a nice amber gelatinous ice, all sliced. A sweat broke out on his forehead. More flair was needed in each dish he was to prepare. Another grab behind him found the horn of a deer that he used to stir three pots while he stared intently at the other six. Next into the mix was hair of a witch, or so the label suggested it. A clip of this created a smoke of thick green into the mix. Chef Hat placed a lid, seeing to this. He waited for the fog to clear and spat a heavy green lung of grit right at the mix, the force of which made him twitch as the spit spat back. He shot a look at her. "Keep watch," he smiled, striding over to the door to burn a cigarette, and while stroking Ben, Ordelia questioned his intent, but kept a watch on both, till when he returned. "This is burned," he slurred in her direction, but cursed his own inception when he learned it tasted better after it had turned. Ordelia shook her head and turned back to the sink. The water had become inviting to drink. The bubbles had dissipated. She felt desperate to taste it, but the crashing of plates then was making her attention now longing to face this. Chef Hat stood hunched over the dishes, inspecting each one for mould or a divot. When one didn't meet the standards, he split it in half over his knee while squinting. Ordelia noticed dirty boards and knives and made her way towards in a slide, collecting the items, returning to arrive at the sink, the insides now alive. The swirls of a substance that reached upwards out of the water to a knife to touch it. She pushed the load over to the edges and watched as it was being dragged in, accepted. A bell rang. Chef yelled, "Pick up!" A young girl appeared as he set up, prepared and sped up, plating another two. "Table 8! Head through the bar towards the one with no headroom." The girl left soon, after he said to. Lunchtime service continued this way, the emerging display of plates presenting an edible array that was given verbal disdain from the bearer when faced. The landlady returned when 2 on the clock came. When learned, Chef Hat simply left, went away, leaving Ordelia to clear up the waste. "Leave the skink boiling," was the last she would hear him say. The landlady approached her and gave a proposal. A late-night bar working shift for a place to stay. She decided that this is probably an easier space to obtain, and with a chance to converse person to face, she accepted with grace.
Well done, another episode down. Time for the summarised version of events. So, Ordelia wanders through the woods, meets Herbert Dean, who invites her to stay for the night at his farm. She considers it, but when she gets there, she senses something not quite right, so carries on to Skellis Gate and then the Traveller's Hall, where she meets Chef Hat, and the rhyming gets a bit weird. Apologies for that. So, then onto the captain, who rolls through a little hamlet, killing everyone but one person after finding out that the brothers have passed through, so he's hot on their tails. The one man he left alive, though, means that the information of his whereabouts makes its way to the Toop via another man in Port Farrington, where they ended up based on Mr. Rook's information. The other follows Ordelia, and we leave him as he knocks on Herbert Dean's house. The kids have a bit of a hailstone moment. They go through a kissing gate and push through the undergrowth behind it and end up separating due to Fenn moaning about his sock being worn through. The brothers don't feature very heavily in this episode, but don't worry, because they do in the next penultimate episode of the season. Not that anybody was worried. But yeah, thanks for listening. It was a difficult one to record, just because I had to keep on doing it. I wasn't happy with the recording, so it's taken a little bit longer than I had originally anticipated. So apologies for the wait for nobody who's waiting for it. And the next one will be out when it's out. But if you do like it, subscribe, share, tell some people about it that you think might like it. It's pretty niche, so the more people that actually hear it and like it, the better, because, you know, otherwise there's no audience. Thanks very much. Cheers. Bye.